Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome, my name is Anne Wilson and I'm delighted to host the Emerge Australia Imagine podcast series in which we speak to people impacted and associated with ME/CFS and long COVID. We acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we meet and pay our respects to elders past, present, emerging, and those listening today. At a time where we have so much unrest in the world, reflecting on John Lennon's iconic song, Imagine, is very appropriate. Let's imagine a world where there are no wars. There is no discrimination or stigma or racism, a world where the voices of those suffering invisibly in silence are heard, seen and addressed, a world where there is a cure for ME/CFS or at the very least a biomarker or diagnostic test, let alone updated clinical guidelines. Imagine all the people. So today I'm pleased to welcome Jenny Meagher and her husband Pete to our podcast. Jenny lives with ME/CFS. Before her illness became more severe, Jenny worked as a speech pathologist in education settings. She has two adult children, one of whom also lives with ME/CFS. Jenny's involvement in ME/CFS advocacy began with the Millions Missing campaigns. She has a particular interest in political lobbying, and we're very grateful that she also works with Emerge Australia in a voluntary capacity when she is able. Jenny's husband, Pete, cares for both Jenny and their adult daughter, and they're both great supporters of Emerge Australia. Jenny and Pete, welcome.
Thank you, Anne.
Thanks,
Anne. So to get us started today, Jenny, could you please take us to the beginning of your ME/CFS journey and tell us a bit about you, why you care about people with ME/CFS?
Okay, well, I'm afraid it's a long journey, but I'll try and give you the short version. 30 years ago, next month, I got sick. As you said, prior to that, I was working, I was very active socially, professionally, physically, loved the outdoors. We traveled a lot, you know, we had normal, wonderful, busy lives. And then we had a trip to the UK and 2 days after arriving in London, I got a terrible viral illness. And basically, I have never properly recovered from that. I should add that the course of the illness has been quite variable in that time. So it's been a long time. It's a long duration, but it hasn't been severe for the whole time. It was a sudden onset, and at the time, people just said, you just need to rest. I had absolutely no idea what was going on. I waited till the school holidays, had a good rest, didn't get better, went back to full-time work, struggled like so many of us did. I just cut out everything in my life except work. And rationalize that as much as I could. And then something happened that was quite unusual for that time was that I got diagnosed quite early, within the first year or two. And this is purely because I was working alongside a visiting teacher for health impaired students. And she said to me, I think you've got this thing called chronic fatigue syndrome, as it was called then. And she gave me a cassette tape from Dr. Kathy Rowe at the Royal Children's Hospital. And I listened to it and I thought, that is exactly what I've got. And so I went to a physician, got an official diagnosis, and he said, don't worry, you'll get better. Of course I didn't, but I did gradually improve and I got to 95% recovery within 2 or 3 years. And I thought, that was it, that's over. Back to normal life. That was unfortunate, but it's all over. Of course, that wasn't the case. And from then on, it's kind of been a gradual decline, but with step downs. So the triggers for the declines over the years have been pregnancies, unfortunately. Moving into state, I had a step down decline. Working part time while trying to raise 2 primary school age children, unsurprisingly, caused me to get worse. And then finally in 2009, I did 2 graded exercise therapy programs. And after that, I just had to give up work completely and my life changed completely. I just progressively lost everything that, well, almost everything that gave my life meaning. And that was when things really got tough. I became very isolated. I fell into a physical and emotional slump. And that was when we were really searching for answers, searching for treatments, getting desperate. Up to that, before I got sick, you know, if I had a problem, I would research, I would deal with it. You know, I was someone who, you know, I had challenges before my illness, but I found a way through. But this illness, nope. It stopped me in my tracks. No matter how hard we tried, we could not find a way to get better, which, of course, is the story for so many people.
Yeah, absolutely. So my next question was going to be about some of the challenges that you've experienced in your journey, but you've already discussed those, particularly in the step change that occurred every time there was a major incident in your life. How did you cope with the loss of what you once had? You know, is that something that you think about a lot? I know you've spoken about the social isolation, but you were an allied health professional, a speech pathologist, and you're also a parent of a daughter who's developed ME/CFS. What are your coping mechanisms, or how have you learnt to cope with the grief and the loss?
Yes, that's a tough one. And I should stress that what helps me and what has worked for me may not work for everyone. We're all different. But when I sat down to think about it, I realised that, yes, I have learnt a lot over the years and I do draw on a lot of strategies. And I think the most important thing, which is made very clear these days, is to stop, rest and pace, as if we can't say it enough. this is what helps, and it's really hard to do, and I'm still not very good at it, and I don't rest enough, and I don't pace well enough, but it really is what we need to do. And like so many others, I just wish that right at the beginning or even halfway through, someone had said to me, just stop working, stop trying to exercise, stop trying to push your way through, rest your body, and you might have a chance of recovery. Whether I would have listened to them, who knows? In fact, we probably had a doctor who did say that, but anyway. That's the main advice, which I think a lot of people are aware of. I have had to learn over the years acceptance, which is easier said than done. So years ago, I remember my GP said to me that I just had to learn to accept this illness, and I was just aghast. I said, there's no way I'm going to accept living like this. This is just unacceptable. However, she was kind of right. We do have to reach some sort of point of acceptance. It doesn't mean that we're giving up. It doesn't mean that we like it, living like this, but we just have to find, I call it an in-between place, to find some peace. And part of that, and Pete and I talk about this a lot, is just taking one day at a time and not looking back too much at what I used to have, and certainly not trying not to look too far forward, but just trying to live in the moment.
And you're talking about a couple that, you know, before illness interrupted our lives. In fact, we were married for 11 months before Jenny got sick. But we used to pride ourselves on planning three holidays ahead. We had in our calendar that was holidays, so far in advance. It was one of the things that drew us together, that we both loved the adventure and travel. Jenny traveled overland from London to Kathmandu and did all these wonderful, crazy things. And now travel for us, and we're lucky compared to some people with ME/CFS. For us, it might be just going down to the coast for a few days and being in an Airbnb or something like that. So we definitely had to go from that life to now just thinking about one day at a time. And when we did move to that, we became a lot happier. We just thought, let's just live in the moment and let's just take the small pleasures that life throws at you. And they're very small, but just accept that, we're a tight family unit now, and we get our enjoyment from that.
Emerge Australia aims to ensure that anyone impacted by ME/CFS or long COVID has access to support, information and advocacy that empowers them with the knowledge and skills to make their lives more livable. We offer support to over 500,000 Australians who face ME/CFS and long COVID.
What a blessing it must be, Jenny, to have an understanding husband and partner who is able to live one day at a time with you and be on that journey with you and be on the same page, because I can only imagine it must be really difficult if you're potentially in a relationship where someone has to work and go fast, and you are feeling that almost you might be letting the side down. So how reassuring has it been for you, Jenny?
Yes, that was one of the big things that I made a note to say, that I'm extremely lucky. I believe the relationship breakdown with this illness is quite high, understandably. And the number of times I've counted my blessings, that I have someone with amazing patience and understanding, and who has believed me and supported me right from the start. To have that belief, someone believed that my symptoms were real and that I wasn't going mad. He has reassured me repeatedly over the years, Jenny, you are not going mad. You know, I feel so privileged, and I recognize that many people don't have this sort of support, and it would be that much harder for them. Yeah.
It must be a bit of a message you've got for families, really, because there are many people who say to us that even in their families, you know, there is disbelief that it may not be real. And, of course, the outside world has all the stigma and all the discrimination associated with, you know, maybe it's all in your mind, etc. So I guess the message to those listening is how wonderful it is to be able to have someone who is your partner and life partner who understands, who gets it, and who believes you.
I think Pam is the thing that really tricks extended family, because, you know, Jenny might rest for a week leading up to a family event, or it might be Christmas or whatever, and Jenny likes to, you know, at least for a day, pretend that, or for a few hours, pretend that everything's normal.
Yeah.
And then we leave that event, and I get to see the, you know, out of everyone that was there, the one person that wasn't having a drink has the biggest hangover, which is always the cruelest part of it, right? So Jenny is suffering for days, and we know that, you know, we hear from people say, oh, Jenny seemed well. It was great to see her well, right? And it happens with family and friends, and they think, well, things can't be too bad because Jenny was bright like she's always been. I kind of feel like here I am picking up the pieces and dealing with the emotional and physical aftermath. It's very taxing.
Yeah, and Pete, I was just going to ask you, you know, as a carer to both Jenny and your daughter, you know, what have some of the challenges been that you've had to face in your role as a carer?
Yeah, so it's often not well understood. I think people don't understand the impact on the patient, but for the carer, it's all encompassing. It impacts friendships, because you really get to the point where you say no so many times, you can't go and do things with the friends that the phone calls stop, if you know what I mean. You know, the message gets through. So you have a really tighter, smaller group of friends when you might have, you know, previously had a bigger group of friends. From a work perspective, it's also very challenging. Before Jenny was sick, I was a department head working for a tech company, very, very busy life. As I've said to people before, being a manager is like being a lot of the time is being, you know, someone's psychologist, because a lot of the job is keeping everyone focused and happy and feeling part of a team. And I'd be carrying that burden, and then I'd come home and I'd be dealing with, you know, the tricky life at home. So I had
more of the same.
Yeah, so I had to turn my back on that, and you know, more than a decade ago, I had to become a sole contributor, which, you know, has a financial impact. It has an impact on job satisfaction, and you kind of, you know, what I've given up is relatively small compared to people with ME, but it has a, you know, it makes life difficult. You sort of start your marriage thinking you're going to live on dual income. You buy that house, and then you realize you're on a single income, and your earning capacity is for that one person is also reduced. But then being that carer, we also have a son who has a disability. He doesn't have ME, but he has a complex disability as well. So I'm the one person in the family who's kind of trying to keep those plates spinning. And just to give you an idea of how difficult it is with the challenge, when our daughter first developed ME, she was away from school for some time, but then she was able to go back to school. And so in a normal situation, you know, it would be the home parent who would take the role of getting the child to and from school because they're not well enough to take public transport or whatever. So I'm trying to hold down a pretty, you know, stressful job, and I have to explain to my manager, and this is before everyone started doing work remotely, that I had to take my daughter to school and pick her up from school, and at the same time I'm trying to hold down a job. So it's
and all the appointments
and all of the appointments and everything. So I've been lucky enough that I've got very understanding employer right now. They understand the challenges of it. It's very much focused on outcomes, but all of those things make life very difficult. And then also when it comes to because it's an invisible illness, it's poorly understood. So you seek outside help. I mean, we're lucky enough that, you know, we've got the resources and we spent a long time and a lot of money to get access to NDIS just recently, which is amazingly helpful. And I know there's a lot of people listening who have ME who haven't been lucky enough to get to that point. So we're thinking of you. But before that, and even the people from NDIS says, oh, why don't you get the council to help? And the council is basically say that it's all means tested. So for me to get help, I have to quit my job. But if I quit my job, I don't need help, right?
That's right. Of course, yes.
Yeah, it's crazy, yeah. Right? So we went for 29 of those 30 years without any help whatsoever. And in the last few months, we've been able to get some help, and it's just a little bit of help around the home instead of me spending the entire weekend doing all the cleaning and So it's very very tricky, but you know, I married my best friend, and so we seem to get up each day and enjoy each other's company and continue on.
And we watch movies. Lots of movies.
Lots of movies, and you try, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds to me as though you are trying to make the most out of every day and be positive. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think you need to, reduce your horizons quite a bit.
Your expectations.
Your expectations. It is hard when you're talking to friends who are telling you about their latest jaunt to Europe and all these sorts of things, and you just tend to shut that out of your out of your life and just take those small pleasures. And even, you know, watching movies. Jen isn't well enough to watch many, but it's a kind of a special thing we do at the weekend where we might watch something on a Friday and then she'll have a headache the next day because she watched a movie. But then she'll so it's those little pleasures are. Spending time together on the couch is nice.
Oh, that's, I mean, it's so comforting listening to you both speak. That's, it's
can I just add about being positive? There's, you know, don't confuse us with people who, Pollyannas, who are
super
positive all the time. Of course, you wouldn't, but we have plenty of bad patches. I have plenty of physical and emotional slumps. I have very bad days, very bad weeks, like all of us. And where I just lie on this bed and stare at the ceiling and think this is just unbearable. So we're certainly not happy and positive all the time. And I think that's normal. And expected, but my mantra is during those really dark, boring times, I have to say, is this too shall pass. And I repeat it to myself. And, you know, eventually I am lucky in that eventually it does pass and I do improve a bit enough to get out of bed. I know that's not the case for everyone.
It's such a unique disease and affects people in different ways, but certainly the challenges associated with having good times and having people see, as you said before, Pete, see that you appear to be okay and thinking, oh, things are better, but not seeing the flip side of that must be very difficult for you to cope with and probably very confusing to anyone else who really doesn't get it, you know?
Yeah. We've also we worked out there's some people that really understand grief. I think some people have had a pretty good life, right? And when they talk to people who are like us, who are dealing with grief every day, right? It's just hovering over us. Yeah. They don't know how to have that conversation. So sometimes it's better to talk to other people who have ME or other people who've, in some reason, and it's not a universal rule, but often the people who've had a tough time are the best people to talk to because they understand kind of what you're going through, even if it might be a different grief that they've experienced.
And there will be a lot of people listening to this podcast who'll say, yep, that's exactly what happens to me. That's exactly how I feel.
They get it. Yeah.
And
a wise friend said to me, she gave me this analogy for grief, and you might be familiar with it. She said, grief is like a handbag. You carry it with you all the time. Sometimes it's a neat little bag the grief just sits in the background. And sometimes it's a huge suitcase that you have to lug around and it just dominates your life. And I just think of that often because that to me illustrates what the grief is like. We can't expect not to have grief for all our losses associated with ME/CFS, but some days it's just a handbag and other days it's a massive suitcase.
And I guess that while we're talking about grief, it's important to remember that grief also comes in many forms. So it can come in the mad, bad, sad, glad type of packaging. So, you know, you can have days where you are very, very angry, other days where you might be extremely sad and depressed.
Yeah.
You know, there's the bargaining part of grief. Why me? Why did I have to have this? And the frustration, and all of those, they don't necessarily go in sequence. Mm-hmm. And not everybody, unfortunately, gets to acceptance, which is something you've spoken about right at the beginning, that you have sort of come to accepting where you're at right now and living one day at a time.
But continuing to go through that cycle, I call it a cycle of grief.
Yes.
That it never finishes, and I still go through anger. Just ask Pete. He has witnessed me throw things around the room. The psychologist encouraged me to throw things, by the way.
So does the glazier.
I've only broken one window. I'd just like to put that out there.
But you know what? It's wonderful that you're able to talk about that because not everybody understands the cycle of grief. And when you get angry, for example, not everybody necessarily relates that to might just be part of the grief process.
Jenny's very efficient at dealing with her grief, in that it sort of builds up to the monsoon builds up, and then there's this amazing outburst, and we actually sort of refer to it as a bit like the Dr. Seuss Cat in the Hat with the red spots, right? So he's trying to get rid of the red spots, and Jenny has this outburst, and then there's red spots all over the place, and then I've got red spots all over me. So what happens is that she sort of passes that grief over to me, and I wish I was as proficient as dealing with grief as Jen, because my way of dealing with it is I go through the black dog really comes to me, and it normally takes me a few days. So I go into a very low, withdrawn, I think I'm difficult to live with at times because of that. But I do eventually come out of it. But I don't deal with it. I think it's more common with males that you don't deal with it by talking about it. You just try to absorb it and hope that it goes away.
And do you ever talk about it? Do you ever go and see anyone about it?
So I have tried. In a weird way, it's I've kind of said before, it's kind of like that joke where you go up to the bar and you order six beers and the barman says, "Would you like a tray with that?" And you say, "Well, don't you think I've got enough to carry?" and so it's kind of like,
I don't know where you're going with that.
It's kind of like, it's a kind of a joke, but I kind of think, what, don't you think I've got enough to deal with without also having another appointment with a counsellor? But I also find that when I have tried that, they say, "Oh, you should go out and play golf, or go away with your friends on the weekend." And it's like, man, you just don't understand this illness. It's, it's solidarity. Solidarity is a really important thing, right? And so I do have to have my times where I do spend some time with friends, but I need to limit it, because I go out and have a good time, and that's sticking the knife into Jenny, because I'm doing something that she can't do. So I have just special occasions through the year where I might catch up with friends, go to the cricket for a day or two or something like that. But that's kind of like a big thing. And, the times of catching up with friends at the pub on the weekend or something like that, it's just, that's decades ago.
So you've got to be extremely considerate, and pretty balanced, I would think.
Yeah. It's a bit like Pam in that, if I go and do this, what's the aftermath, right? And so if I go and do something, but it's going to make it harder for Jenny to accept that I'm going out and having fun and doing things, I've just got to keep that quite limited. And I've spoken to other people with ME, and their carers are in a similar situation. It's just one of those things where you just have to show the solidarity and go on the journey. And luckily for Jenny, I actually like spending time with her, all those things I used to do.
Gorgeous thing. That's a really lovely thing.
We have a bit of a system. He does go swimming, mental health swimming, we call it, and swims laps. And it's hard for me because I introduced him to swimming. I used to swim every week, a kilometre or two, and loved it. But he needs to do it for him. So we have this system where he says to me, "Is it okay if I go for a swim?" I go, "Yep." And then when he comes back, I don't want to hear anything about it. I don't ask about it. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to smell the chlorine, nothing. And that way we manage.
You build up your own systems and processes.
Yeah. So I actually went for over a decade, instead of going for a swim, I went to the gym. And Jenny was never a gym goer, so I thought if I went to the gym, that was kind of okay, because swimming is one of the things that she just loves, But then, of course, with COVID, I just had to give up my gym membership because, it's a petri dish for COVID, and introducing COVID into a home where there's already two people with ME is probably not the smartest thing to do. But.
We want every Australian diagnosed with ME/CFS and long COVID to receive effective medical and support services without stigma or discrimination, so that they and their carers can receive the appropriate care to help them manage and improve their health to the extent they are able across the lifetime of their disease, while we work towards a cure.
So I'm going to change tack a little bit here. You're both passionate advocates for change. Do you think Australia is getting any closer to improving outcomes for those with ME/CFS in 2023?
Yes.
No. yes. Well, the answer is yes and no, right? So there's a lot of really good things happening, but every once in a while we see things in the media or somewhere where we've gone back a decade in terms of thoughts about graded exercise and things like that. And it's like, man, are we ever going to get over that? Are we ever going to be at a point where there's an acceptance by the media and health professionals that this is not a thing that can be fixed by thinking yourself better or.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you think about the last 10 years, particularly the last five, particularly since long COVID, you know, the change is happening, and I think it's happening at a faster rate. Those of us who've been watching for so long, you know, the research is just that the good biomedical research is coming out so much more frequently. You know, we've got so much more evidence now. The guidelines are changing around the world, as we know, in the US, the UK. We're creeping closer ourselves. There is greater awareness, there's greater discussion in the media. The politicians, I remember the frustration of about 13 years ago when I was isolated and I just thought, I'm going to write letters because that's what I know. that's all I know I can do. So I wrote letters to politicians. I wrote letters to The Age, still do. And, of course, it was ineffective. It was isolated. But I could just see we needed action at the government level. I have watched for so long, and I can see that the you know, it's the loudest voice in the room. It's the squeakiest wheel lobbyists who get the attention and get the resources. And although we shouldn't be competing with other illness groups, we can compare with them. And we can see that we're just not getting our fair share of government resources. And I think it is useful to look at other examples like multiple sclerosis, MS, where there are about 33,000 of them in Australia, and they got, I just looked this up before, 18 million recently from the Medical Research Future Fund.
Yeah.
So that was $500 per patient. I mean, you know, this is the stuff we dream of. So I think that we are getting better organized all the time. Patient groups, patient organizations, we're becoming better at becoming political. So a lot more has been happening in terms of like the parliamentary friendship groups. A lot more has been happening in Senate estimates, lots of government submissions going in. For us to get, you know, a full mention in the long COVID report, how good was that compared to 10 years ago? You know, this is great. So, yes, things are changing, not as fast as we'd like. But we've just got to keep at it.
Oh, how amazingly encouraging is that to hear? So I've asked this question of many people on our podcast series, but it's a particularly pertinent question for both of you, and that is, what would you do if you were Prime Minister for a day?
Go to Kirribilli House.
Is that all?
I'll let you answer. Yeah.
I mean, I guess there's the shopping list of requests that we have, which basically would be the implementation of the 2019 NHMRC report recommendations. It's there, it's sitting on the shelf. A lot of great work went into it. I would just implement them, those recommendations. Same with the long COVID, more recent long COVID report recommendation 8. Implement them, get it done, non-binding. Senator Steele John has just set up an inquiry. He's got an inquiry through into ADHD, which is wonderful and it's needed. We need the same thing. We need the same level of attention. We are sicker, we are more disabled, we are more invisible. We need this sort. We need an inquiry with stakeholders and patients that leads to recommendations and leads to real actions. And of course, we know that includes updating the guidelines, getting doctors educated, right, starting at the medical schools right across the country. We need expert clinicians, a specialist, so we know where to go to instead. At the right at this moment, I'm juggling 6 different specialists, and it's exhausting. We need easy access to NDIS, DSP, and other government supports. At the moment, it's an uneven system where people like us, where I have an advocate and we have the resources, I was able to get access. If I had to apply for NDIS without my advocate, it would never have happened because I would not have the cognitive or the financial resources. Unfair system, same with DSP. All that needs to be fixed, Bill Shorten. And I also would organise an apology in Parliament. I think we deserve it, for decades of medical and government abuse and neglect. A public apology to us all, because we have all suffered so much neglect and stigma, and there is so much trauma, and this trauma needs to be acknowledged. And that is what I would do.
Wow. That's why you guys are such amazing advocates. And in hearing all those things that you listed, I guess I'm pretty pleased that Emerge Australia is working on all of those fronts. Mm. I can't say we've started work on an apology, but what a great idea. A statement from the heart might be good too.
Absolutely. Lots of parallels.
Just on one page.
That's right. So, yes, you've hit the nail on the head with everything that you said and everything that Emerge Australia, of course, is working towards. So, and we're just so appreciative of the work that you do for us when you are able, because it's always brilliant work. So finally, we'd all like to think that the lived experience brings with it wisdom. What have you learned in your journey that could bring hope and light to those people who are living with ME/CFS? What can we finish this off with on a very hopeful note from you?
I guess reaching out to community, and I think a lot of people say this, the ME/CFS community has been a lifesaver for me. The moment I discovered Facebook, which was, I have to say, well after everyone else discovered Facebook, and I discovered the online community, what changed my life. and reaching out to our community for support. There are the Facebook groups have just proliferated. So there's a MECFS Facebook group for every occasion and every need out there. And, you know, people are wonderful. You just ask a question, ask for support, ask, do you just, people just make posts and say, I've had a really shit day, this is what's happened. And there is so much support out there. There really is. And I think that's a great strength that we have, that we can at any time get support, get advice on doctors, on treatments, on medications, you know, that, yeah, it's great.
Denny and Pete, thank you so much for your time. We ran a bit over, but your messages are just so important for everyone to hear. So we thank you so much for your willingness to share with us and be so open about your experiences. Your stories are so important and so inspirational and instructive to others looking for hope. So thank you for coming on our podcast series.
Thank you, Anne, for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you, Anne, and thanks to the Emerge team for all the work.
Oh, that's a pleasure. So the Emerge Australia Imagine podcast series seeks to speak to people of influence and those whose voices need to be heard. This is a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID. If the content of this or other Emerge Australia podcasts has triggered an emotional response for which you need assistance, feel free to contact Lifeline on 131114, their Crisis Support and Suicide Prevention Service. You may also go onto the Emerge Australia website where emergency services are listed. Tune in again for our next interview, and soon we will be announcing an entire series of interviews with some of the world's leading clinicians and researchers. So please stay tuned, and for all the information on the work of Emerge Australia and what we have lined up for you in the coming months, you can subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter by going onto our website on www.emerge.org.au. Jenny and Pete, thank you so much, and bye for now.
Thanks, Anne.
Bye-bye.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only